And we're live with our 301st episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host, Seth Law, at Seth Law, also on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. It's apparently going to be one of those days. We're flying in a little bit late because we were catching up and talking about all the things that have been happening, you know, personally in our lives, but also in, across the industry, what we wanted to talk about today. Appreciate all the love from the last episode, you know, on the 300 and, you know, actually making it to that target. I don't know if it was a target for us, but to that milestone, I should say. Feels good to, you know, have such a great community and everything else, you know, that goes along with that. Outside of that, there's a couple things that I did want to bring up. We have the virtual training that we're going to be giving here shortly, just a few weeks. This is harnessing LLMs for application security, learning all about how to actually utilize LLMs, like programmatically create agents and break down AppSec tasks using LLMs. You're going to get a lot of feedback and experience on what we've tried to do, what has worked and what hasn't worked. I think that's the biggest takeaway, especially as we talk on a daily basis. There are specific things that LLMs are really good at, and there's things that, guess what, normal traditional AppSec patterns work better at. So yeah, we're gonna dig into all of that at that, you know, for that course specifically. And then there is the European version of this, the Black Hat version, that is going to combine secure code review and harnessing LLMs and implement your own agents. And this is a 4-day course. It will be a lot more intensive and a lot more hands-on because we have a lot more time to actually dig into these different aspects. And then finally, we can announce that we will be running the harnessing LLMs course at KernelCon. So that's April of next year. This is way, way far out. Obviously, right? Like, it's October and we're already talking about April of next year. That one will be, signups are already available. They've already like confirmed that they want us there. We've taught at KernelCon in the past, and it's a great place to actually go and get these courses in person. We're not quite sure how many more virtual courses we will run. It's going to depend on demand. So you will have to watch out for these courses as they pop up and we're doing them in person. Yeah, Ken, outside of that, I know you've got a couple of items on your agenda. You're going to be traveling. Well, I guess not really traveling, but you know, contesting with traffic getting into DC, I guess, in next week, right?
Yeah. So I was going to tell you, I don't know why I would tell you specifically, but yeah, actually I'm actually going to do a hotel so I don't have to drive. Cause last time we did it, it was like 2 years ago. We had a booth in DC and I had to drive home from DC to where I live, which, you know, you've been there. I live in the country. DC is not in the country. So yeah, not going to do that this time. I'm really excited to see everybody because it's like last time it was in DC. I mean, we got to catch up with everybody that we had worked with, for one, tons of people we just either had worked with previously or just like knew from the industry or from the podcast in some cases or whatever. And then trying to think, like, there was one other thing I was going to mention that was really neat about it. Oh yeah. Well, actually, by the way, Brian Glass, who's coming on the podcast on November 10th, had showed up and we were able to all go and get dinner, and that was amazing as well. So just from the sheer, like, being able to catch up with friends, it sounds crazy because like I technically could see a lot of these people, but not really because I'm so busy. So it's like a dedicated spot where we can all, I don't know, catch up. I'm excited about it. And also, yeah, like, there's a lot to talk about. Everything's changed in the industry over the last 2 years, right? So, or I say everything, but a lot of things have changed and shifted. And so it'll be interesting to hear you know, I don't expect to see like another talk on cross-site scripting, right? Like there's just too much interesting stuff going on. I mean, there probably will be, but you know, my point is it'll be, but mostly it's just very interesting stuff that's gonna
happen. Come on. I submitted a talk about Crocs and socks, about logging, and it did not get picked up. I don't understand what's going on here.
Well, dude, I actually was going to give away like some tips on how to build your own agentic orchestrated software security tool, and like uh-huh. I was going to share like the things we learned that like aren't good, that are problems, that are going to lead you down bad, you know, rabbit holes, and then share the right strategies and all that, and they still didn't pick it up. So I was like, all right, I guess that's not of any interest to, like, you know, build your own agentic tooling.
It's not like it's relevant nowadays, but yeah.
Nobody's doing it, right?
I'm not going to be there, right? Like, I was hoping to make it out and life got in the way. And I'm sure I'm going to have serious FOMO come those days as everybody's getting together and I see pictures and I get texts from people that they're going out to drink and, go get lunch or dinner or whatever it is. Yeah. But nobody does value logging as much as they should or as much as they say they do, right? Like, you know, we give lip service to logging, but then, yeah. I guess run reveal, like probably Evan would dispute that because he does put a lot into logging and actually gathering logs because that's the basis of their whole platform.
Yeah.
So it should be interesting. I'm excited to have Brian Glass on. So that's that week after Global AppSec DC, specifically because they are launching the OWASP Top 10 for 2025, and he's a big part of that. So we're going to talk through what the OWASP Top 10 is, what the new list will be, and why they came to the conclusions that they did. Mark your calendars for that one because it's going to be a good one. It'll be one day shifted. I think we had some scheduling conflicts, so it's going to be the 10th of November as opposed to our regular Tuesday schedule.
Yeah, I'm headed to Texas, so I couldn't make that Tuesday. But Monday, it'll be very exciting because, like, one thing that people always seem to be very concerned about with good reason is, you know, how is this data derived? What were the data sources? How is it synthesized? How did we come away? Like you said, what you just said, basically. And he's going to give a nice breakdown, but also opportunity for people to actually dig in on those questions. And, you know, so if you want to have a meaningful, deep conversation, November 10th, Brian will be on.
Mm-hmm.
Last time.
I know it was. Yeah. Oh, it's just popping in the OWASPTop10.org website. If people want to kind of prep for what has happened. So if they're interested in the process, Brian and that team have tried to make it more transparent than it was in years past. Obviously the last couple of iterations, they've been leading that effort, but you can go check that out there. So to your point, last week was LastCon. Last week was also SaintCon. That's where I was. What were you going to say about LastCon though?
Well, I was going to ask you about SaintCon. Before I do that, let me just say for LastCon, I had posted that James was giving a talk on promise theory and how that is essentially impacting, you know, AppSec and software security. But he gave the slides away, so I'm putting the slides in here. Now that that's over and you can access these slides and hear more about like promise theory, which is fairly interesting. I wanted to hear more about SaintCon because I know, like I said, LastCon and SaintCon both last week. I know we had talked about this months ago, how they were during that same week. It was a bit of a conflict. How was it? How'd it go?
It was actually really good. So SaintCon is a little interesting because it didn't come up as an application security conference. Like LastCon is the Lone Star application security conference, right? So it's right. Definitely more, our typical crowd. SaintCon started as there was the networking tool Saint and then it's a play on, it's in Utah, right? Like SaintCon. But it came from that kind of networking crowd. There's a lot of physical security, networking focus, pen test focus, product focus, but it's fairly large at this point. I think there was, it sells out a conference center down in Provo, Utah, probably 2,500 to 3,000 attendees. We ran, the local OWASP group that I'm involved with, we ran the AppSec community, right? So, you know, beginner challenges on, hey, come learn about SQL injection, cross-site scripting, the OWASP top 10. And then we had like a whole like AppSec carnival where people had to give tickets to exploit different things and win rubber duckies and then fix the code behind the scenes to get bigger prizes, right? Like it was a whole effort. But it came off really well, to be honest. Like I spent most of my time on the floor with the community, with the AppSec Carnival. And it was really good to connect with some people. Like they brought in this year, so Jason Haddix was there. I had a good discussion with him. Mubix was there, so I had a good discussion with Rob as well. Right, like it one night, you know, going out to dinner with all these guys, and it was good to reconnect, right? Like to your point, a lot of them will be at AppSec DC, right? Global AppSec DC as well. So you'll probably be able to, you know, make some of those connections there. I don't know, like one of my big takeaways, like obviously, like always talking to Jason, and they're doing such like great stuff at Arcanum Security, like especially around AI testing, the framework to actually go after AIs. He's involved with the Libertas GitHub stuff now, right? Like all the payloads for AI testing. They've got this new tool, or it's not new tool, but they'd updated a release. It's called Parcel's Tongue. I'll have to post that in things as well. I had it up somewhere. But that's for encoding, right? Like encoding payloads to actually test out various LLMs and see what bypasses and other things you can actually drop in there. So that was really cool to see. But, you know, as I'm talking to him, we're like, oh, the space is moving so fast. He's like, yeah, I feel like I'm constantly behind. I'm like, you're a cutting edge, Jason, right? Like, if you feel behind, there is no help for the rest of us, you know. So, it was good, right? Like, obviously, like, there was a lot that happened last week. There was a lot of connections that were made. And was happy to see that, because it St. Con in general, to my initial point, has never been very AppSec focused, but there is, it is expanding into that space. So similar to DEF CON or some of these other traditional security conferences, AppSec is just having a bigger piece of the pie, right? Like it's becoming a bigger piece
of the pie. Mm-hmm. That is interesting to hear. That's actually really interesting here, because I kind of thought, but I was concerned that maybe like AppSec would be shrinking, right? Influence. By the way, that explains why I couldn't find Parcel Tongue. I was Googling it. It was like, nope, I was like, Parcel Tongue comes up in many other. Okay, yeah, it's because it's an elite code or elite speak written. Okay. I love I'm reading Robert's comment. I love the community dynamic conference a lot for the emphasis. It's such a unique thing to treat a conference as a social gathering beyond just a professional environment. Yeah. Cause like to that end, I mean, there's people who live 20, 30 minutes away from me who I never see unless I fly across the country or even sometimes to another country. And then I'm like, hey, it's great to catch up. Mm-hmm. It's not, it's wild, but like, that's the reality of a lot of our lives, I think. Yeah, it is.
It is. Well, and I had this question, right? Like, I know we talk about this after like DEF CON and other things, that Hallway Con is so important, right? But I had a question from kind of one of the other volunteers that helps with the AppSec community and other things. And, you know, he asked, he's like, why do you keep coming, right? Like, why are you doing this after so many years? You know, because obviously, like, you've seen like most of the talks are just iterations on what you know other research topics, and you know, why do you keep showing up year after year? And it's to free this swag. Point, it's it is definitely not the free swag, as in I don't think I took any this year, right? Like, But it's the hallway con. It's seeing the people that I haven't seen. It's, you know, making those connections. Sometimes the talks and the communities will teach me something new, for sure, right? But, you know, it's being able to hang out with the other, you know, Wasatch, AppSec, the OWASP group, people, and connect them with them on a level that we normally don't, because we're too focused on this single like presentation or whatever it is. Whereas hanging out with them for 3-4 days in a booth, and we're talking about family and work and, you know, current strategies for solving problems in their spaces and what they're dealing with, is not something that you get in short snippets, right? You need that hallway con in order to have those sort of that sort of engagement.
Yeah, and I mean, you also need to, like, it's 11 o'clock at night, I'm exhausted, we've had maybe some drinks or maybe not, whatever, but you're like pretty tired, you're up late and you're talking and you're just like throwing stuff out, and then boom, something hits where you're like, oh, that's a great idea. And it is a great idea, and that would never have come up if you didn't just like totally get into a different world altogether mentally, or yep, different space altogether mentally than like, if you like, yeah, it's because it's the same thing we were actually talking about prior to this podcast starting, where it's like, when you're just like chopping down trees all day long, it's pretty hard to zoom out and see the forest for what it is and how much progress you've made.
Yeah.
But it's also hard to, you know, zoom out and think strategically about, or even just like come up with new ideas, if you're just constantly sort of, you know, work, right? So it's nice to get away for that reason. I'm very, like I said, I'm very excited to have for OWASP Global DC. Next year, I will definitely making it out to SaintCon next year. And actually, I'm going to push for us to sponsor as well with SaintCon. I think it's a valuable one. And I know this is kind of the winding down of conference season, which is kind of nice to kind of go out for me on the OWASP Global and then Black Hat next month in London. And then kind of just get back to just kind of some heads down focused stuff, plus like spend some time with my family, because, you know, I'd like to spend some time with them. So yeah, this is nice for that. But anyways,
yeah,
what do you want to get into talk wise since we have like a bunch of stuff to discuss?
Let's talk about Atlas.
Okay. Pulling up the link.
You know what I just realized is speaking of conferences, I was like, oh, that's right. Like Cactus Con is going on. Oh no, the CFP is closed. Dang it.
Oh no, I didn't submit for it in time. Oh no.
I know. Well, we might be able to talk to, you know, an organizer or something and see if they need a workshop. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about Atlas. This is OpenAI's response to Google Chrome. Right? This is their implementation of a browser. And the arguments that have gone on up to this point are, really, we need another browser for this, right? Like, do we really need AI in the browser in the same way? So initially, right, like right off the bat, what are your thoughts about having AI, you know, so embedded in something that you use to browse the web?
Yeah, and I should say that I did. So I had commented on this, but my comments, I initially made a comment, and then I kept reading after I had made a comment about, a public like quoted comment. And then later there was even more information that came out and more considerations. And so I guess why I'm saying that is, like, at first the immediate like thought in my head was, dang, like, you've just given, like, privacy and security are incredibly hard to get right in browsers. There are whole companies dedicated to it and still don't get it right. So I'll just say that flat out, like, that's just a hard premise to, or a hard thing to do. And then, and that's really not their specialty, right? They're not a browser company. They're OpenAI. They're making frontier models. Like, they're not, this isn't their bread and butter. So now you've taken AI and added it into the mix where there's now additional security concerns because there's autonomy involved. And now that privacy and security concern of just regular human beings using the web, I would say is significantly exacerbated by a brand new browser, which is just, even if it wasn't using AI, it's a brand new browser. So all of us listening to this podcast should have the same thought, because we've seen this over and over and over again. Historically, it never turns out well when a browser gets shipped. They almost always within months will have critical flaws. And then as time goes on, we'll have even more issues. And then things start to get a bit better, but there's always that initial, like, researchers go to town, find a bunch of issues. And in this case, this was just like prompt injection in the response. It was placed into an image. So it was obfuscated. It was the word I was looking for. Obfuscated, not visible to the human eye. And then, LLM interprets the content, and then it has a prompt injection and a bypass and goes and potentially exfiltrates nasty things and all of that. The thing is, though, is like I said, so even if you just don't have AI in the mix, I'm already concerned. Now you throw AI in the mix. But the last thing I'll leave you with is that after I'd made that comment, I had read, I'm going to mess up their name. I think it's Ioman. I'll find the name and I'll paste it. Maybe if they've accepted my friend request or whatever on LinkedIn, I can give them the link to their thing or whatever, or maybe even without it. But anyways, they had a quote that really struck a nerve with me, which I really agreed with, which was, so now you have, think about like what Google did with Chrome and all of, and Gmail and all of the access to everything that they have about you, and how we all know that we have essentially a digital social security number that tracks everything that we do online. And it's highly invasive. And privacy is a very murky word in this world of browsing. And so now you're saying, and we all know AI companies are fighting tooth and nail for data, right? Like, we just saw Reddit literally throw a honeypot out there to catch Perplexity ripping off their content when they're not supposed to and putting it into their data set for training their LLMs. Or at least that's the alleged stuff that came out. So we know that AI companies are, and that's just one example. There's many, many embattled, there's very many situations, I should say, where AI companies are fighting with various folks over data collection. So I'm saying this to say, like, you basically just reinvented on a massive scale Google, but like with way more intimate knowledge of you, because let's be honest, you and I, Seth, may not have conversations with ChatGPT that expose certain aspects of our personality or whatever, but I am certain that many people are having very deep conversations that are very targeted and contain real, like, things that would be embarrassing if they were shared. And so all of that interesting data about you as a human being is now combined with your browsing habits. And I basically think it's like, I think his term was the phrase he used was something like, it's capitalism's final form or something. And it's worse form.
Final form.
I was like, yeah. And I was like, it's a pretty prescient view, and I would agree with it as well, that is scary as hell. So anyways, that's my, like, there was my feeling initially, which was just security and privacy. And then there was what he threw on there, which became like, well, forget what I'm saying. Like, that's a bigger implication that I really didn't think about it. And I, you know, hey, I'm an idiot, whatever. I didn't think about it, but I was like, damn, that's crazy. You have surveillance to the nth level at this point, basically. So what are your thoughts on AI, or not just Atlas, but like Comet and just AI browsers in general?
My big concern with them is the context, exactly what you're speaking to, right? Like, the AI in general, depending on how far you trust it, has so much context about what you're searching for, what you're like actually browsing, what your current concerns are. It's going to become another ad stream, if it hasn't already, on how they can actually insinuate themselves into your view, or your, like, they can speak to your current needs and interests, and doesn't always take into account privacy and safety as we would expect. I know, like, in security in general, we have a tendency to focus on very technical controls, right? So if I look at it at a base level, this is a natural progression, right? They're using Chromium, right? Like, so Google Chrome's engine, they're building their own processing and their own UI into that, that is utilizing OpenAI and is utilizing your current session, which has all of this context information about you, right? And not only that, but if we're trusting it, if we're logging in to with that browser to all of these sites, it's going to start pulling additional information and additional context out of it. That's just inevitable. I mean, you know, to your point, I posted that link to the AP News article about Perplexity and Reddit, and I was having this discussion with other people during SaintCon, because everybody's talking, and so everybody's not necessarily talking about the risks of AI, but people, I was shown multiple conversations that people have with ChatGPT and Gemini about very personal things, you know, how to like help talk to their teenagers about very specific like situations that they are in. And I don't know if those people that I talked to during SaintCon would want that information in their browser and then communicated and used to target them for ads about insurance, ads about, like, you know, Amazon products that you may like, right? Like, it's just, we're crossing boundaries that we don't necessarily understand because we're moving so fast. On the flip side, how useful is AI when you are doing generic internet searches?
Very useful, actually. Way better than, like, clicking on links and going to shady, crappy sites that look like they're made with GeoCities.
Exactly. I mean, it might be the same information, but the summary that's being provided to us via Gemini from Google, you know, from OpenAI at like Microsoft or Copilot, right? Like, those are incredibly effective and useful. It's very rare nowadays that I actually go and click on the links when I'm asking Google things. It's more of a, hey, did the Gemini answer suffice? Right? Especially technical, right? Like technical asks that I have about how do I accomplish X, Y, and Z, right? How do I, you know, change this parameter for this framework? I don't have to go dig into the developer documentation anymore. I just get a dump of what it is. And maybe not nine times out of 10, but probably six, seven times out of 10, 60, 70% of the time, it's correct and it's what I'm looking for.
It's correct. Let me ask you this. Did you think that AI companies were going to get into the browser space? Like, was that something you thought might happen someday?
No, I didn't necessarily target that. Like, if we look back at our like 2025 predictions, I don't think we targeted or we said specifically AI was going to get into the browser. Now that it's happened, I'm not surprised because, again, they've got to turn a profit at some point. Right. I don't know if OpenAI is profitable yet, and they spend massive amounts of money on energy to actually run these models and answer these queries. What has paid for the internet at large? Ads.
Sure. Very true. It's what powers most of the internet.
So not overly surprising that Google has gone that route. Not overly surprising that OpenAI, you know, now that, you know, hindsight is 2020, but looking back, I guess I'm not overly surprised that they're moving that route, or they're going that route.
I mean, I am, and I'll tell you why. I thought,
okay,
what I expected to happen was that they would use, like, maybe this is really silly, but I would have thought like the Claude desktop kind of app, where it's a it's a chat client app, but it's like web search would only be a part of its functionality, right? It's, we're just talking about a client that can go to the web for, to, like you said, to get answers, right? And reference things. And because that has been, you know, I spend so much of my time with Claude desktop, with Windsurf, with Cursor, with Claude Code, because of, you know, there's various reasons, product related, I won't get into all of them, but I need to have those available to me. So I spend a lot of time in them. And yeah, I realized at a certain point, I don't go to the browser very much anymore. Like, I go to the browser for, you know, like Google Drive, for spreadsheets, I do use the web for even for this podcast, for looking up articles that are relevant, and my email and things. Well, I have an email client, but there's still reasons I use the web. But I'm starting to see a shift where a lot of my time is actually spent in talking just with different AI systems rather than through the browser. So I actually assumed it was going to go the opposite way, where the clients themselves would subsume the concept of even browsing the web, or then, and I know that sounds crazy, but I thought the web would start to change a little bit, and maybe it still will. I don't know, but I didn't expect for us to lean more heavily into web browsing as a client. I thought it would actually be leaning more heavily into a set of AI agents and sub agents and evaluation judges that decide, like, okay, this is the best information to take from the web to give to you, or from other whatever data sources it's interacting
yeah.
with. So I thought so the way that the web was working and developed for, and their clients would change. That's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I can understand that inclination. I start to think about it from the general population's perspective, though, right? Like, so you and I and everyone that we're talking to on the podcast or is listening is more tech savvy than the general populace, right? So we are utilizing, you know, we've been utilizing Copilot, right, from GitHub for years in the browser as an IDE plugin, right? And we're naturally in the IDE on a daily basis. So, of course, that is our view into LLMs and into these AI systems. Now, take, you know, somebody that's a normie, right? Like, I guess, like, for lack of a better term, right? A general normie is going to use the browser to look things up via Google or Bing, or, you know, choose their search engine. And if anything, I have seen people in my life actually use like ChatGPT on their phone or Gemini on their phone, the apps, the specific apps. And the natural progression there is they are clicking those links. Like, they ask ChatGPT, and so it's opening the browser, or they're already in their browser, it's opening another tab in order to interact with their life online. So the natural progression for ChatGPT and OpenAI is to combine those two and capture the experience in order to maintain like a consistent look and feel, and to control the user over time and the user's eyeballs, right? It's the same reason that when you click links on, like, in any of the Meta platforms, in Instagram or Facebook or whatever else, that most of the time nowadays they keep you in an embedded browser because they want to control your eyeballs, and they don't want you going outside of their garden in order for them to capture the ads and to capture the revenue that's associated with that and keep you in their experience. So I'm getting cynical, but that's like the engineer in me sees the, okay, we've got to keep people on our platform, right?
I mean, when you're predicting the future, it's best to bet on cynicism than it is to bet on an idealistic world of where it could go. And in this scenario, you're betting on having more control over what users see and how they use the web and how you can collect their data, which is the cynical view, but also the correct one, in my opinion. And also historically, that has always been the way it's gone. So it does make a lot of sense.
Look at X, look at, you know, Grok, right? Like they want to keep you on the X platform. So they're going to provide an AI that you can interact with there and make it really difficult to actually go use a different AI. Same thing with, you know, Atlas in this case. So guess what? If you want to do AI searches or whatever, they don't want you to go to Google and see Gemini's results and like take you out of their experience. They want you to stay here. Again, we are the product, right? How do you keep that product actively engaged and So anyway, if we can figure out, you know, if we can figure out a way to monetize that from an AppSec perspective, it's going to be great. And with that, we're launching our own AppSec AI, right? Like our own AppSec, Absolute AppSec browser, right?
It's going to be a, I'm kidding.
A hacker tracker. Exactly. I'm putting a browser in there.
Well, I can't wait for my Atlas book. You know, that's going to be great. Or my comic book.
Exactly.
We'll see. But you're probably right. I mean, own the device, own the apps, ecosystem, own the way people browse, own the data. You own everything. That's the reality. OpenAI creates new birth. Yeah, that's actually an interesting thing too, actually. So I saw this company today that was called, give me one sec. I can pull it up for you. I have the link here. And I thought it was an interesting proposition. Here we go. Yeah. It's called the irregular. They basically do evaluations on frontier models for how they perform with cybersecurity tasks. And they give like a punch card of how well it performs or doesn't perform with Claude and OpenAI and then different cybersecurity tasks. So like, I don't know, malware reversing or doing, I don't know, SOC stuff or AppSec stuff or whatever. So that's pretty cool. I didn't even know that existed. Does make sense, but yeah. And I find that interesting because I've noticed like some of the AI companies, not some of them, I mean, let's be honest, I think all the major AI companies are trying to learn the business cases of the different companies to include one like my own, and then trying to subsume those businesses by and become the like the one true brain essentially that everybody goes to. How that'll work out, I think it's a little too ambitious because having done this, like it really requires like deep orchestration. I can tell you, no matter how good you think your model is, there's going to be caps. That's why I have to use like a ton of different models, and they have to be used for different purposes, and they have to be backfilled with different data, and evaluation has to be really on point to make sure we don't deviate even with small changes. I don't know. I think like I wish them the best, I guess, or not, or whatever. I don't know. But I do think these AI companies are going to find that after a while, it's going to be pretty hard to subsume all these different business cases, because you do have like, that's just not. And I'm sure someday I'm going to eat my words and they'll figure it out and all that stuff. But right now, the way the attention works, the way the training and the way it works fundamentally actually leads to some real gaps that you have to like fix basically. And there's a number of ways to fix it, but it's not always just training a model better.
Well, and I mean, so, even the papers, I thought it was interesting. Yeah, it is right. Like I, my initial take on that is, you know, I question like the evaluation framework and the other things that they're using, what they're testing against. It looks like they've got a solve framework. The amount of effort that you need to go through to actually evaluate all these different things. This is a good start. Like it's a good place for someone that is trying to build on top of AI to actually go to see what which models are performing best, especially in security tasks. But you're still going to have those custom questions that you're asking. You're going to have to build your own evaluation framework, right? I don't see you getting away from it, because your task, how you're trying to solve problems, the agents that you're using, the prompts that you're using are going to be different than company Y. And one model may perform better than another, even though it doesn't score as highly, you know, using their scoring system, right? But that's, it's an interesting problem that we're running into. Again, that deterministic versus non-deterministic answer. There's no.
And actually, I wonder how I can get James to talk about it. So, because like I that's actually what promise theory kind of addresses, is that that belief of determinism. Not to get too flighty or out there with it, but essentially, like, we think determinism means I can run this same check that will, you know, it'll definitely find, it will never have, like, if I run it 500 times, it will never deviate from how it behaves 500 times. The problem is that you're applying that, what you believe to be a deterministic check, to something, the code and the way it's changing, to, or the way it's developed, if it's not like a code change, you're applying that deterministic check in a environment that's non-deterministic by default, right? They're not going to have all those 3,000 patterns you're looking for. It won't make sense. All you're saying is that I'm deterministically looking for the same crap that may not even matter at all on what I'm scanning. So that's my very dumb way or simple way of explaining his talk, or parts of his talk, I should say, and how promise theory lines up with it. But that was very interesting. I think that's an interesting concept. So determinism, yeah. These days, I've started to like kind of cringe and back away now when I hear people say, well, it's determinism versus probabilism. I'm like, well, there's probabilism in every bit of code that's developed, period, right? Like it's not going to look the same. Has any app you've ever looked at looked the same as every other app, even inside the same company with the same devs? No, that's not how that works. So it makes sense to me. But yeah, started to kind of push back on the deterministic thing now lately.
Yeah. Is it like, should we be saying predictable versus unpredictable, or?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Predictable rule. No, I don't know the right answer, actually. It's just a theory. Theories are, you can pick them apart, but
yeah,
it's an interesting thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's see. We've got about 10 minutes left. So many articles. Come again. Well,
can I just share? We don't have to talk about it too much, but the CoFish one was semi-interesting, and I don't think it requires too much of a deep dive. That's why I figure I could just drop this link and people can go read it. But I think it's worth mentioning. Did you have a chance to look at that one yet?
I haven't. So let's talk it through. Like what was the, yeah.
Yeah. So the high level is that, actually, yeah, let me share my screen let's see here, share screen, window, new CoFish attack. Okay. Should see it.
Yes.
What the hell? See, I'm getting fished while I'm showing fish. I'm going to get trolled. So this, oh my God. Thanks a lot. Well, you know what? Actually, bleeping computer should get trolled for that. Anyways. All right. So, well, that was awful. So just edit that out, I guess. Anyways. All right. So long story short, in Microsoft Copilot Studio, they essentially allow for you to build these like agents, and they do like a demo. You know how you can do like a demo site thing, and then it pops up a URL that people can go and access and demo that thing that you've put online. It's like, you know, if your code space is you develop some code, you want somebody to like connect and whatever. So they allow for that, right? The problem is those, well, the first problem I should say is that really that is that the URL that's generated is a Microsoft URL, right? And the way this all, if you visually, the reason I wanted to pull up the website is just to show the visual on this. When you go to create your agent, right? And your agent is essentially what it sounds like. It's a kind of a chatbot agent type thing. What they realize is that they can put in, and this was a researcher from Datadog. I forget her name. It's Katie Knowles. So Katie Knowles at Datadog, you know, wrote up this article and did this research. But what you can do is you can set up, you can set it so that it actually redirects to like your server, for instance. So meaning you can get the access token exfilled without anybody ever seeing the exfiltration happen. So they go to sign in. Basically, they access your URL, they go to sign in. They do sign in. They don't really know that anything bad's happened, but you can add a step that they won't see that exfiltrates their access token. So for a period of time, you get permissions scope to, I think their scope was something like email and chat. And yeah, here it is. Email, chat, calendar services, things like that. So anyways, this goes through all of the details that you need. But yeah, they show using Burp Collaborator to exfiltrate the token, the access token. And so it's essentially phishing through creating a fake sign-in that looks real, that kind of is real. Everything happens through Microsoft URLs. So if, for instance, you did get your Collaborator server did get a request with the access token, it would be from a Microsoft URL, which could be very confusing, right? Where it ends up, obviously, ultimately is your server. But again, all of this activity is happening through the Microsoft systems. So while it does require social engineering, because you do have to get somebody to go to this link, at the end of the day, it's also a very like likely to succeed type of issue, social engineering attack, because, I mean, like I said, it all looks valid. Plus, it's AI. So everybody's kind of just, you know, clicking on things and installing things and kind of the Wild West out here. So interesting. Any thoughts here from you on the article?
Yeah. I mean, this kind of stuff feels like a natural progression in like attacks against AI systems, right? The legitimacy and the trust that we place into Microsoft and the GitHub and to Google and other places as we're building these agents is pretty incredible. It feels like, yeah, like people throwing out the wisdom that they've earned over the years on, you know, trusting of big companies because, hey, I want to use these new features, right? There's no real response from my perspective, right? So yeah,
OAuth is hard too. Like, man, I was having this conversation internally because we had this company come in who does like application security assessments, and they really stink because they find good stuff and make me fix missing CSER parameters. And no, all jokes aside, like, yeah, when you guys found that, it was great. And I had to explain to the team, and it was fun because we got to like actually walk through showing the exploitation of it. And I had to explain, it's like, you know, OAuth is effectively stateless. It's trying to make stateless interactions stateful. You know, it passes back these various codes, but you have to verify, you know, like where those, like with CSERF protections like that, you know, this was an intentional, this is the person sending this code through this handshake intentionally meaning to do it and to connect it to their account kind of thing. And just kind of breaking down the different steps along the way where OAuth state, kind of, there is no state, how it tries to make a state. It was very, very interesting and fun thing to do. But also, I wanted to also point out, I'm not going to talk through it. I just, other than just putting it on here, we Seth and I found this pretty cool Next.js security testing bug bounty guide. Seemed interesting and Kurt, like, kind of, I skimmed it, seemed cool. So we dropped it here and in the Slack channel, in the general channel.
Yeah. Yeah. I like, I have stories about Next.js, right? Like doing code reviews for a Web3 company. Found some issues. They were very immature and told them they shouldn't launch, and they still did. And then a developer decided to make private. They basically pushed live into production private tokens in the public token like repository that's available to everyone, right? Like, so you know how Next.js is meshed, right? But one of those happened to be the private key that they used to sign and move money on chain, or move tokens on chain, I should say. So yeah, you can imagine what happened, and they came back to us, and this is, you know, we talk about the secure code review process, right? Like, and having like GitHub like commit numbers in there. They came back to us and they're like, "You guys didn't catch this, right?" And we're like, "No, nope, this was not in the code that we looked at, right? Like, look at that commit. It was done like 2 months after, right? Like, as you were pushing to prod." Anyway, so Next.js,
yeah,
be careful. There's a lot of foot guns there because of the fuzzy lines between public and private, and what's running client side versus server side. It's well defined within the framework, but it's easy to cross those boundaries. So I appreciate like getting these checklists like this. This is all the sort of stuff that we end up building internally when we're dealing with new frameworks. So it's good to see just be other people actually share this sort of these sort of patterns and checklists.
Yeah, it is very nice. I know, like, I know you and I through the years have tried to do this whenever there's like a framework that we specialize in, and it's so helpful. Like, really, that tribal knowledge it's really everything, you know. Especially if you're, and I know like bug bounty people, what's really great about bug bounty researchers is they, you know, will specialize in something like this, just Next.js or just Rails or just whatever, right? And then you get like this tribal knowledge that you could only get from someone who spends day in and day out inside of these frameworks. So thank you to who, actually, I don't really, who was it that I posted the article? I don't even remember who was that, deepstrike.io. Thank you to deepstrike.io.
Yep. And Daud Youssef, right? Yeah, great write-up in general. So sweet. Well, we have been going for just about an hour, right? I know you and I are busy. Is there anything else that you want to talk through or mention before we call it today?
I guess one last thing I'll say. I did find it interesting. Like, I saw. I think it was last week, Sneak trying to advertise their new agent. This cracked me up. I kind of trolled it on LinkedIn, but I was like, it was like the world's first agentic AI orchestration platform for security. I was like, sure about that? You absolutely. Anyways, I saw them talk about how next year they'll release something along those lines and with their Evo. And I was just, then I saw, and you know, then like Black Duck also announced they're doing something similar. They even had our name, our company's name, Dry Run Security, on the PowerPoint at LastCon. And it's just kind of interesting to see like the industry has like decided, yeah, this is where it's going. So there's no going back. Even the big players are trying their hand at at least marketing around having those capabilities, and it's eventually building them. So no turning back. Pandora's box is open. We're throughout the industry's decided to go.
Keep going back to it, right? Like, if you're not utilizing AI, you're going to be left behind. So come take our course.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. I'm going to go straight on the notes. Yeah. Learn how we're doing it. Tell us how we're doing it wrong. Come prove us wrong, I guess, is the takeaway.
And get a job if you can do it. I'd love somebody to come in and be like, no, actually, this is the better way to do it. All right, you're hired. So,
sweet. All right. Well, appreciate everyone, all the comments today. All the articles. Always good catching up, Ken. We will see everyone online. Yeah.
Sorry, before we go, there's two people I know of that are senior software security people that are looking for roles. And these are fairly senior people. So if you have a need for those folks, I've already gotten DMs from some folks, but if anybody has a need and hasn't DM'd me yet and wants to, go on Slack and do so, please. I'm drinking coffee now. I'm just burping. So sorry, I'm going to shut up now. Back to you, Seth.
Nope, that's good, right? Like, if you are looking or you have a job to offer, there is a jobs channel in Slack as well. Just love to, link people up that are looking or are seeking expert level talent, right? Well, good. Appreciate everyone, like I was saying, and enjoy your week. And if you're going to Global AppSec DC, I'll be missing out next week and I'll be jealous, but post pictures in Slack and other things so you can increase my FOMO. That's all.
I know. Oh yes, and I wasn't gonna say that, but since it's, should I say that or no?
Aaron, we don't necessarily need to put that out there, right?
Okay,
it's all good.
I was gonna say something. All right. Cool.
All right. Have a good one, all.
You'll have a good one later. Bye. Ciao.